let's talk about is recorded and produced in Treaty 1 territories, on the original lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. Thank you very much for listening. Hello and welcome back to Let's Talk About for another episode in the Tech Talk series. Honestly, a couple weeks ago, I was wondering if how much further I could push this little like mini series I've been doing before I have to get back to other different stories and other different topics that have been coming up in the news. But I keep finding and being sent really cool things. And this episode is no different. I was sent something this weekend by the beautiful folks over at my publisher, Ravenstone, and I just, this is such a cool idea that is currently being tested, and it has the potential to be, how do I phrase this? It's, when we're talking about climate change, we're talking about strategies to mitigate climate change and to respond to climate crisis and the gradual shift over from, you know, our post-industrial capitalist way of thinking to a greenified economy. There's always going to be questions of how do you make these changes without disrupting the system too much? Because a lot of the changes that have been proposed are quite radical, and sometimes people who propose them are talking in very radical terms and things that will shift beyond what people are comfortable with. If you think about, you know, politically and economically and all of this, people tend to sit in the middle. A lot of, especially here in Canada, a lot of people tend to sit kind of in the center on a lot of issues. And people don't like disruption. The COVID and the supply chain issues and the recession and all of that have really shown that in a lot of ways, that people don't like their kind of calm, quiet, normal life being disrupted in any major way. And climate change, unfortunately, and climate disaster, as the name, the term disaster implies, really shakes things up and really changes things. But this is a way. This technology that I'm going to talk about today is a way that we can greenify the transportation of raw goods in shipping. I've mentioned quite often on this show when we're talking about climate issues that there are really three major sectors that produce the lion's share, the vast majority. I think it's like roughly 70-80% of emissions come from these three sectors. That's energy generation, shipping, and manufacturing. Those three things are the largest contributors to greenhouse gases here globally. It's not just a Canada thing. It's a global thing. If you think about it, we need to power things. We need to make things. We need to move those things around. So if we can greenify those, if we can start generating electricity and power in an energy efficient, a green, ecologically friendly way, that's going to save us a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. It's going to bring down our carbon footprint significantly. If we're able to, you know, manufacture things in a green, ecologically friendly way, that's going to bring down our carbon footprint. And if we're able to move the things that we make around, the things and the people around, in ways that are built, have built-in structures to reduce the impact or offset carbon in some form or way, we can really make a big dent in our carbon footprint. And this is what is being proposed by CO2 Rail. CO2 Rail is a US-based train startup that has plans to capture carbon directly from the air as its modified train cars crisscross across the country, negating the need for large facilities to take out carbon from the air, which was said in a press release released by CO2 Rail recently. I'm reading from an article by Ameya Palea in Interesting Engineering. So this is essentially a train car that has a carbon recapture system built into it. I'm going to get more into the details in a second. But this article makes very good points, and CO2 Rail is making very good points about the costs of carbon recapture technology. Now, we talked about Climeworks previously and Capture previously, which are providing tools to capture removing blue carbon, and Climeworks reducing like carbon from our atmosphere. They have these, in terms of Climeworks, they have this scalable solution with their climate recapture, their Climex units, and, you know, their Orca facility. They have a scalable system, but it still requires land to use, and they've built the Orca system in the Orca facility in Iceland. And I talked about how with a scalable system, you're able to save a lot of the land demand and the space demand that something like the carbon recapture systems require. Same thing, Climeworks, or Capture, it's a little bit different because it's a skiff that goes out on the ocean. So it doesn't take up land per se. But this really cool idea with CO2 Rail is to retrofit or to put on these CO2 train rail cars onto existing train lines and utilize the sprawling rail systems in North America to move these train cars around and capture carbon as they go. Rail, for a lot of different reasons, is a very carbon, you know, it pushes, you know, traditional freight trains push a lot of carbon into the atmosphere because they require a lot of fuel to run and to move. You know, we think about original steam engines, they used pure coal. Now we use, you know, diesel and gasoline to power the trains that we currently have. And, you know, I actually got stuck behind one, or stuck with a train going by when I was on my way back from the lake this weekend. But, you know, we have these trains that are crisscrossing the country right now, spewing tons and tons of carbon into the atmosphere, leading to a very large carbon footprint. So what this will do effectively, and I'll talk about this more in a little bit, is provide a way to make, at least in the short term, freight shipping on trains carbon neutral. In a very simple way, it's just attaching a couple, one or two, depending on how much carbon is outputted by these trains, a couple extra train cars onto the train that can, as the train goes along, be capturing and storing carbon that can then be resold to make like pharmaceuticals, is one of the things that's mentioned by CO2 Rail, or just injected straight into the earth, as we've mentioned a few times on this show. But back to the article. So, quote, direct carbon capture is a straightforward method to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The captured carbon can be utilized for other purposes, such as making pharmaceutical ingredients, or simply compressed and sequestered under the earth. Currently, the methods deployed to capture carbon directly from the atmosphere require vast amounts of land and energy to get this done. Researchers at CO2 Rail, along with the University of Toronto, have therefore devised a new method that can tap into the existing rail network and capture carbon from the atmosphere while passenger and freight trains make their usual rounds. And when I was talking about integrating them into pre-existing life, so life is not disrupted as much, this is what I'm talking about. This is not asking all trains to be pulled off the rails and all retrofitted with energy, like battery engines, or swapped out for new locomotives. It's not asking for that. It's just modifying the pre-existing system so the system continues to work as it's always worked, but you're adding on this solution that is able to mitigate the costs of doing business in a very simple way. Eventually, I know we will have to move to a system, or it will be more viable to move to a system, and eventually all freight trains and all passenger trains will one day switch to battery operated, electric trains or maglev tracks, things like that. Really cool bullet trains, all of those options. But this is a good stopgap until that happens. So how does the technology work? Back to the article. Quote, the researchers plan to use purpose-built train cars equipped with large vents to take in the air. Since this will be done as the trains move at high speeds, it will eliminate the need for fans, usually deployed by stationary direct carbon capture system, saving significant amounts of energy. That's something that in the Climework system we talked about is basically a large air conditioner . It takes in air on one side through a fan, puts it through a membrane and chucks it out the other side, puts it through a filter and chucks it out the other side. And this works the same. Back to the article, quote, the train cars will be equipped with chambers to collect carbon dioxide, which will then be concentrated and stored in a liquid reservoir inside the train. The carbon dioxide free air will be released back into the atmosphere from the back or underside of the rail car. So as the train moves forward, air will be sucked in through a vent at the front of the car, pass through the collection chamber. An array will, it will go through a filter or will go through some sort of membrane that will pull the carbon out of the oxygen or out from the air, and then that air will shoot out the other side and continue on. Maybe it will hit another of these train cars, or it'll just continue on, and that carbon will then be distilled in a liquid form inside the train car, which then can be dealt with in a specific way. And this is a quote from E. Bachman, the founder of CO2 Rail. He said, quote, every 12 hours, a crew change or fueling stops, the onboard CO2 reservoir is emptied into a normal CO2 tank car located at the station. When a sufficiently large group of these tank cars have been filled, a train will be made, and perhaps as much as 10,000 tons of captured CO2 will be shipped into the circular carbon economy as a value-add feedstock or directly by rail to geological sequestration sites. This should not be challenging at all, as the CO2 rail cars were designed for approximately 24 hours of continuous operation before needing to be unloaded, and engineers need to rotate approximately every 8 hours. And this is talking about how staffing works and how engineers operate on trains, which is not too relevant, but what this is essentially saying, or what they're essentially saying, is that there is a lot of, we're talking about gigatons of carbon that need to be removed from our atmosphere and our oceans every year. This is a way to do this relatively quickly. If it's 10,000 every 24 hours, 10,000 every 24 hours that can then be put into this circular carbon economy. If we're talking about becoming net zero before we can become net negative, instituting this circular carbon economy to maintain the level of carbon that's on Earth or in our atmosphere or kind of circulating right now, this is a great way to do that. But we can have hundreds or thousands of these cars, these CO2 rail cars, collecting 10,000 tons of carbon every single day, and then removed and sequestered together, put back into the earth or back into the carbon economy. So this is a way that has some scalability built into it. So like Climeworks with its scalability, where you can have multiple of these units and you can stack them, array them in whatever way you need and have as however many as you need, and it's easy to upgrade and expand. This is has a similar function. You just need to add more cars to whatever train you're on to provide a more significant carbon sink, to remove that carbon from the atmosphere. So continuing back with the article, how is this thing powered? Well, quote, in a conventional braking system, the friction due to the application of the brakes generates heat that is released into the atmosphere. Quote, every complete braking maneuver generates enough energy to power 20 average homes for a day, said Bachman. So we're not talking about a trivial amount of energy. The article goes on to say, by using a regenerative braking system, trains can convert this into electrical energy, which can then be used to power the direct carbon capture process. The researchers estimate that an average freight train could remove about 6,613 tons of carbon dioxide every year. So it's not 10,000 tons a day. Sorry, I'm not going to go back and change that. It's 6,000, roughly 6,000 tons of carbon dioxide every year. Per car, we can get to gigatons fairly quickly. So doing some quick math, if we are hitting that target of 6,000 tons per year, you'll need roughly 160,000-170,000 of these cars to pull out a singular gigaton of carbon from the atmosphere every single year. That's not a trivial number. That's not a small number, but it is manageable when you think about how many train cars are currently on the rails on Earth, or at least in the very, you know, closer to home in North America. According to 2020 estimates, there were around 1.6 million rail cars in North America. So that is a smaller percentage of the overall, and it's just expanding the number that we have. And again, this is scalable. If you want to remove more carbon, you just need to add more rail cars. In a world where we have something like a carbon tax, having something like the CO2 rail train cars, it's a great way for certain companies who are the bigger polluters. This goes back to a really early episode, but you know, the average person doesn't pay the carbon tax. It's large corporation and large polluters who pay the carbon tax. We just got our CAPE payments here in Canada, so that money came back to us through the Climate Action Initiative payments. So this would be a great way for rail companies and transport companies to offset their carbon and thus receive savings on their carbon tax, or eliminate their carbon tax almost entirely by instituting some of these cars, by putting some of them in, and then they have the value add that then they can take the carbon that is being collected and sequestered in these tanks, and they can sell those, as was mentioned in the prior statement. So really, it's a way for these large companies to offset the carbon tax that they're paying, to get or eliminate it entirely, and add a little bit of extra value for them by being able to take part in the circular carbon economy. Just to finish off this article a little bit, quote, the researchers are keen to utilize the rail network since it's an infrastructure that already exists, and its deployment to capture carbon directly could further reduce carbon emissions since rails are more efficient than the road vehicles like trucks. Quote, by increasing rail utilization, you increase the efficiency of the entire transportation system. Using the rail system could also deliver additional benefits, such as freedom from zoning and building permits that are needed for large-scale capture methods. Over a period of time, these purpose-built cars will become a regular feature of all train systems and become unseen by the public at large. That's the end of the article, and that is a very, very great point that I harp on a lot with these Tech Talk episodes. These are small, incremental changes that, when they come together, can make a huge, huge difference to our day-to-day lives, and they just become ubiquitous in public life. Think about, you know, wearing a seatbelt, wearing a helmet when you go biking, having a driver's license, you know, people who you having your insurance, like all of these different things that just become ubiquitous that we may not have had before. But, you know, when they first happened, seatbelts, when seatbelts first came into being, people were not used to them. They were, but it was a small change that had a very large impact. That is now just so ubiquitous, you know, it'd be strange to get in a car and not buckle your seatbelt. You feel weird if you don't put your seatbelt on. So when we're talking about these climate mitigation, these climate disaster mitigation strategies, and these little things that we can do, we're talking about these incremental changes, ones that become just ubiquitous with everyday life that you don't notice anymore. You talk about the surcharge for putting on the energy efficient coating on your rooftop for the phase shifting material conversation that we had a few weeks ago. You talk about Climeworks and having, you know, right beside your air conditioning unit or on top of your apartment building or your office building, having some of these Captura machines on there, continuously capturing carbon and being able to be sold and resold in the circular carbon economy. And then we're talking about these rail cars that, I mean, the art has them as bright green with solar panels on the top. I don't think that's what they'll actually look like when they're on a train, but it essentially looks like one of those big black liquid tanks, you know, the fuel tanks or the gas tanks that rail cars already have. They've just got big fans on either, or big vents on either end at the top. We're talking about these small changes. We're not talking about one solution that will just completely change our lives and save us from the worst of climate change. We're talking about incremental changes. We're talking about little things that are just going to become so natural, so normal that we don't even notice them anymore. And then it's pointed out by CO2 Rail in this article. That's what we're looking towards. So when I'm talking about these stories, and I'm purposely trying to find ones that are just small and ubiquitous, like how many of you, aside from just seeing a Tesla on the road, because, you know, the Tesla brand and the look of the cars is very unique, how many of you now drive a hybrid? How many of you will be able to pick out an electric car on the street? I actually saw for the first time an electric Mustang. Ford released a full electric Mustang, which is the version, I think, I believe is a crossover. I saw one recently when I was driving. I was like, oh, there's one of those crossovers. My girlfriend and I are talking about potentially when one of our cars needs to be either sold or is at the end of its life. We're talking about getting an all-electric F-150. I've been in love with the F-150 Lightning since I first saw it. And I was like, I want to get that truck. So there are these changes. There are these things that seemed so crazy back in the day that are just becoming normal and ubiquitous. Nobody complains about driving a hybrid anymore now that they have them. They have hybrid trucks. Like, there's a hybrid F-150 out there. There's a hybrid Dodge Ram. There's a hybrid Toyota Tacoma. Like, you have hybrid Jeeps. You have hybrid trucks. You have hybrid vans and SUVs that, you know, the only difference is they sound a little bit different. But people are driving them every single day and they're becoming ubiquitous in day-to-day life. And this is one of those solutions. This rail car is one of those solutions that's going to become ubiquitous and it's going to make a change. Recently, I had a conversation with my girlfriend about, we were just talking about like the future and what life we thought life was could be like and you know, bringing what the ethics of bringing children into the world. And we had this conversation, and I brought up the fact that compared to when I first started learning about climate change, and I started learning about the future that was possible, that seemed likely at the time, and what the projections were looking at like at the time, it was hard not to become nihilistic about everything because the projections early on, when it was becoming the public was becoming more aware of climate change and climate disaster, when it was still like this thing that's going to happen in the future. Now that we're living in it, we're seeing a very different thing. We're experiencing a very different reality than what was projected back then. And not because the projections were necessarily wrong. At the time, with the world we lived in the, you know, the early 2000s, the late 90s, when these projections started, when they were first projecting out, what's 2020 going to be like? What's 2030 going to be like? What's 2040? What is the likely scenario if we stopped, if we didn't do anything right now? It was catastrophic. Like, we were talking about entire ecosystems dying. We were talking about millions of deaths. We were talking about massive famines and flooding and droughts and the end of the world scenario. But now here we are, and the more recent projections say, like, you know, 2040, we're looking at this 1.5 degree increase, which it's going to cause some serious damage, and it's going to cause some irreparable damage, and we're already seeing a lot of the irreparable damage. But we're not in this doomsday scenario anymore because of so many minor changes. Also, so many major changes, because we had, you know, large countries and unions buying into this. We had some large corporations buying into the fact that, you know, for selfish reasons or not, buying into the fact that we need to make a change, or very soon we're not going to have a planet to live on. And a bunch of people bought in, whether they're doing them for selfish reasons or not, and we were able to bring that projection down to where we can survive. We can make this. We can get this done. It's going to suck. It's going to be uncomfortable, but we're going to be able to survive, and we're giving ourselves and our children's generation and our grandchildren's generation a chance. And that's amazing. And it's ubiquitous. It's little things like this. This is the seatbelt of the modern age. This is the no smoking section of the modern age. Having small climate capture units, having phase shifting coating on your roof shingles and your siding. It's having, you know, these random train cars that their entire purpose is to capture carbon, these little skiffs that go out into the ocean and rip carbon straight from the ocean water. It's these little things that you're not going to notice that are making a huge, huge difference for our lives today and our lives in the future. And that's all we're asking for. I've got about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to start to wrap up here. I'm not sure, as I've said multiple times, I don't know how much longer the series is going to go. It's not like, you know, the War Story series from back a few years ago, where I had Remembrance Day was the cutoff date. And it's not like the Exploring the Charter series, where as soon as you get to the end of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, it's over, the series is done. I don't know how long this is going to go, but I'm thinking I might get near the end kind of soon. I don't know, unless I get sent something really cool, or I find something really cool while I'm just kind of surfing the internet. I don't know how much longer this series is going to go, but I'm enjoying it so far, and I'm enjoying talking about stuff like this. I'm going to leave this article in the show notes, by the way, about the CO2 rail. So check it out if you have a moment, and give some thought to it. It's a pretty cool concept, and I'm hugely enjoying it. Next week, I will try and get an episode out next week, but I will be away the day before the holiday, and the day of when the show goes live. So actually, I'll probably be back that day anyways, but maybe I'll do it live in studio. Probably not. But the week after that, I will be gone, so I'm going to try and pre-record some episodes so you do not miss a single thing. But thank you very, very much for listening. If you're listening live on 101.5 UM FM, keep that dial at 101.5. Got some great songs, great shows coming up right after this one. If you're listening on Spotify, thank you very much for your download, like, share, all that good stuff, and have yourselves a wonderful, wonderful week.